Right, okay everyone. Thanks for making it down here today. Today we're going to deal with something which many people have tried to find out a lot about, which is the Peter Power terror drills. These were four terror drills which were concurrent with the explosions, more or less, on July the 7th, 2005. And many people have asked me, after reading my book or hearing about it, what I saw about it, because I only briefly mentioned what I saw. Some of you may not know, there was a what they call a triage point on Tavistock Square itself, on the grass of Tavistock Square. And I saw this in the first 60 seconds when I ran down Tavistock Square after fleeing my flight from the bus, which was blown up. So you've got to ask yourself, if I saw this, I saw the bandaged man, I saw the man with a camera, I heard wailing voice, I looked across the road and I saw a young man in a fluorescent bib. If you take a look at the handout I've made, it shows you on the second point, the young man in a fluorescent bib across the road. Now, there were people who were actually trained. They were part of this terror drill which Peter Power says up to 1,000 people were involved. Now, 1,000 people involved, that means there are at least 250 in each location. So we have to ask ourselves, who were these people? Can we identify them? And maybe there were more than four actual locations, because there was a lot of radio talk about there being six locations.
Can I initially briefly today and ask you, because I've heard another complete different version of it, that is to say that this exercise was simply a PowerPoint presentation in a room with a few people, with simulated participants, in other words, 1,000 simulated people.
Well, that goes against what Peter Power said himself and what I saw that day in Tavistock Square in the aftermath of the fourth explosion. I've got a few pictures of the actual terror drill, because what happened was there was a terror drill earlier at 8:15. A lot of people are unaware of this. They don't know the difference between the terror drill and then the people in the aftermath, the walking wounded. You see, if you look at this picture here, this was the actual terror drill itself. There were people outside at 8:15. You can see the workers. Some people are just, there's some Transport for London people. There's this lady in a bib here. There are these people in this warm protective stuff. None of these people's face is dirty and marked with the soot from the underground. That's one of the things you notice in this picture. There's a chap from the underground there, a lady having a little conversation and a smile with a colleague of some sort. And there are three images in this series which were taken at the same location, the same day, at 8:15. So that is what I consider to be the terror drill, okay? Unlike that, we have post the actual terror drill, where there are people walking about after the actual explosions take place. As you can see, there's a lot of different stuff going on. People have real blood, people have soot and dirt from the underground, and so on and so forth. So that proves there in itself that the difference between the actual terror drills, which were done and dusted by 8:15, 8:20, and then the actual explosions, which many people lost their lives in. I think I've got another picture. This is a walking wounded at the location of Brunswick Square. So if you look at that, there's Brunswick Square in the background. Her face is covered in soot and ash. This is one of the people on the terror drill. Actually, that's later. If you look at this woman, she's walking around wearing one of these coats with a blanket, offering it to someone. And this is Tavistock Square, which was 9:47, an hour later. This chap here is called Tony Calabrese. If you look at him, Tony Calabrese, he is one of the people who was actually on the upper deck of the bus. He leapt off the bus and trying to save himself. His girlfriend, Tanya Calabrese, saw the people drawing the actual safety danger tape, "Please do not cross" tape, across the Tavistock Square from the corner to the square itself. So these people are actual witnesses of the time that the explosion went off and how they were still preparing Tavistock Square as the explosion took place. There they are. That's the guy who was on the floor. His name is Tony, and the woman in front is called Tanya Calabrese. So you want to get a good look at those. There you go. And that's him down on the floor there. They're tending to him. He just leapt over the edge. The roof came up and off, and he just jumped out of there because he didn't know what was going on and he just wanted to save himself. But they're Australian nationals and they went back to Australia safe and sound. So that's another thing which needs to be clarified, what this woman saw. And you can't deny that she didn't see it because she's sitting next to her boyfriend who's down there on the floor.
So Daniel, can you just remind us what actually happened on the top deck of the bus? The bus top actually got ripped off. Was it ripped off from the front or the back?
The explosion was at the back of the bus. From where I was downstairs, I was standing in the part where baby buggies are normally kept. Okay. And what happened was the blast happened. The back of the bus kind of collapsed on top of the three ladies sitting on the back seats, on the back two seats. One of them, I never saw her again. Two of them were on the floor huddled down where I was, and they were about to scream. I don't know what, but nothing came out of their mouth. They were just in total fear and shock. So I departed to the right and I just ran off that bus within 10 or 15 seconds. But the blast actually tore the top of the bus off. And that meant that the people at the front were more or less unharmed, but the people at the back were sprawn, their remnants were sprawn all over the Tavistock Square. In fact, the blast was such that it jolted the bus forward about 6 or 7 feet. It acted like a boost because the driver had actually come to a halt, and the bus kind of jerked forward as well. I noticed that when I fell and hit the floor. You can see what happened in the aftermath of the bus here. This was the bus in front, the 205. This chap here is the bus driver looking to see what happened to the bus, because you can just about make out the bus in the background. So if you go like that, you can just about make out the bus in the background there. And then these people start saying, "Hey, it's time to leave," as you can see. So that was a 205. Let's go back to that. Yeah, pause it there. That's it there. So as you can see, it has no roof. It's just, and there's a bit of a haze of a smoke from the blast. So this is within the first minute or two of that bus exploding. So that's there for your, okay, you got that, Tony? Right, okay, the next thing I want to show you is this chap here who appeared. His name still unknown, 3 years after the actual incident. This man appeared relatively fast, within the first 60 seconds. There's been a lot of talk about him online, who he is, who his identity, where he works, who he works for, but as yet is unknown. He was, it turned out, one of the people involved in the terror drill, one of the thousand or so people that Peter Powell spoke of. And I realized this because he was also spotted in Russell Square after, in the aftermath of the Russell Square, and then he was taken to Tavistock Square an hour later. If you want to have a look at this footage here, you'll be able to see how his journey went. Let me see, these guys carrying him off. Oh, that's him. I think we've seen that one. I think I'll move on for the moment and show you actually the map of where the bomb took place, and how, if you zoom in, this was where the walking, this guy was here, and the bomb was up here at the front. So you have to ask yourself, how can a man be on board the bus and actually receive such injuries and then be ahead of the bus, when there was a lady who was covered in blood from the bus, the same blood that you see splattered up all over the British Medical Association. She was behind the bus at the time, so it gives you an indication of the blast direction and where the people who died were located. This interesting character was located further up here, which is
that's quite an important addition. Can you just explain how you know that person was there just seconds after?
Because I heard his voice initially. He was wailing, lying on the pavement, wailing, and as if he'd sustained some kind of injury. And the woman who was covered in blood from the shower of blood which was thrown over her as she walked behind the back of the bus, I was actually helping her at this point and trying to take her to a location further down the Tavistock Square, which was called Linton House, which is around here, not far from that bus stop which I just showed you people scattering from. So it's a place called Linton House, and we passed this interesting guy here at that. Hi there. We passed this guy as we found that, as we tried to get to some kind of form of safety. This is the bus in the aftermath. As you can see, the back is like totally collapsed. Where I was under here, and I was on the floor as well. There are also some people at the back who were actually crushed. One of them was an Australian woman. Her neck, she sustained neck injuries from how she had been forced down. The roof of the bus above her had actually crushed her to a certain extent, but she was okay. She survived after a few months in hospital. This here is the view from Russell Square. To actually move from Russell Square, you'd have to come out of here and walk down there, and that is where the actual terror drills were. That is a place called Brunswick Place. Yeah, the place called Brunswick Place, and that is where the real terror drill from the morning at 8:15 was carried out. And then the later one, you see the people with faces covered in ash and soot from the real explosion, eventually turned up about an hour later. Okay, now this is some footage of the bomb's aftermath.
This could be all 3 seconds. This could be all 3 seconds. Went out. This could be all 3 seconds. This could be all 3 seconds. Went out. Outside the gate. This could be all 3 seconds. Went out. This could be all 3 seconds.
This is one of the guys from the BMA.
Outside the gate and saw this absolute carnage.
Okay. Right. If you have a look here, this is the scene afterwards. the back of the bus is totally collapsed. I think I'm hovering around here. I may have darted all the way down there to get as far away as I could initially, but then I kind of got curious about what was going on. If you notice, there's some doctor parked his Jag there, so that shows you how early it was, because that was removed.
So the bus is the bus facing away from this? Or
it's facing away, it's facing down. So that's the back of the bus, that's the front of the bus. There's the Tony Cancer Calabresi down there being treated, so we can
blast at all.
There's myself catching a bit of a wondering what's going on, whether should I stay or should I go.
I woke up with my head on my knees and realised there was something in my mouth. I don't remember anything of the blast at all.
Now, the thing that I kind of found confusing, they went to these people and said, can you please explain what happened on that bus? Now, they have people like this lady who says she doesn't remember anything about the blast at all. And she had to be helped off the bus about 15 minutes afterwards. The two girls on the floor were too frightened to leave the bus. I just got out of there because I thought about, hey, maybe there's a secondary explosion about to take place. But the two girls were like cowering on the floor. Obviously, they had no idea what was going on. But I knew instantly that it was a bomb, so I decided to get out of there. Now, for whatever reason, the media began to seek out survivors who had no recollection of the blast. And that's why today we're still scrambling around for this kind of proof, and the only proof up until now that things were pre-planned are Peter Power himself. So what I'll do is I'll go on to something to do with Peter Power, but first I'll show something to do with let me see this guy. Okay, this is another. If you look up there, that is the direction of Russell Square. And to her left, down here, is where Brunswick Place is. So all the actual survivors would have walked down that street, more or less. And who appears here? Okay. There we have an interesting character. This person here, this is a man by the name of Peter Jones, or we assume his name is Peter Jones, but he is the person who was supposed to have been on board the same bus as myself and witnessed an Asian man acting strange with a rucksack. So there again, we have to ask ourselves, what is this man doing here in this location? We know he's walking towards the direction of the terror drill, which is about 2 minutes from where he is, the terror drill in Brunswick Place. So again, how can a man be on the bus in Tavistock Square and be at this location? Is he like the bandaged man who was at the terror drill and then repurposed? Anyway, this man had a lot to say about what went on the bus, even though he purported to be on the lower deck, and I never saw anyone fitting his description on the lower deck of the bus. I was the only male passenger on the lower deck of the bus in the last phase, and there were about three females and the bus driver, and that was it on the lower deck. Okay. Right. Are there any questions so far?
One of the weirdest things about the bus bomb for me is there's a strange picture with everybody who was on the top deck sort of stood on the top. I don't know if you've seen that picture, and they look as if they're a bit lost and they're not sure where they're supposed to be going. Now, I don't understand why those people were still there. If it was me, I would have got off the bus straight away. And I wonder if you've got any idea. I mean, was the stairway blocked or anything?
The stairway was destroyed. So that's quite simply the reason why many people had to wait for some assistance to actually get off the bus. The stairway had collapsed. There was one woman who tried to get down there. Eventually, actually, she waited for someone and she was actually extracted. But no one else got off that bus unassisted, apart from there was an old African man and another woman who kind of slid down the sloping back of the bus. And I saw them get off and walk down towards UCL. And there's evidence of that on the web. But other than that, everyone else had to wait to be extracted. It was quite confusing because the first thing I saw was those guys scratching their heads standing at the top of the bus as I got 25, 30, 40 meters away from it. And I was, to me, it just didn't add up. If the bus had no roof, something had destroyed it, but there were people there. So that was one of the first things which said, oh, this is going to be one confusing day, you know. So I hope that answers your question to a certain extent. I also had another question someone asked me, which was the British Medical Association had some blood all over its kind of emblem, its logo, and this must have been some kind of occult symbology or something, somebody said, and they must have deliberately done that. I said, no, the blast actually tore people and flung limbs and parts hither and thither, and I'm not surprised when I saw the amount of blood on the actual British Medical Association itself, because I saw people walking down, their coat was showered in blood. They had just been walking past, you know. They had blood all over their coat from head to toe. So if blood is going to be showered, there's no reason to expect that parts wouldn't be flung far and wide. So, yeah.
Did you see the guy on the bus who they claimed the suicide bomber?
No, there's no evidence of any Asian person on the bus. And on the lower deck of the bus.
I mean, he probably would have blown himself to pieces anyway, so how would you know? I mean,
so they say.
It's an important thing. You're on the lower deck.
Yeah.
You're not necessarily going to know if there's an Asian guy upstairs.
I boarded that bus at Euston. I was about the fourth person to board it. I pushed in, okay? It was hectic out there, and I just wanted to get to work. So I actually stood there. And I asked the bus driver a question. I said, does this bus go to Angel? And then he said, no. And then I looked at him because I tried to get on the previous bus and the African driver, the same African driver I showed you in that picture, told me you have to get the 30 from over there. So that made me doubt what the number 30 bus driver was saying, because this guy here had told me to get the next bus and I got the next bus. Anyway, so for that reason, I stood downstairs and waited for people to go past me, and they were all asking questions. They were as lost as me and saying, does this bus go here? Does this bus go King's Cross? Does this bus go everywhere? And then no one fit in the description of that guy. I think his name's Hasib Hussein. He's some big hefty guy with a big massive rucksack. Now, I was standing there, people were brushing past me. I never saw no big hench guy with a rucksack go past me. That's it. Now, people might like to speculate that he was already on board the bus from a previous bus stop. I mean, that's something which someone has tried to suggest. I actually saw an individual with a grey, light grey top and a dark grey two-tone rucksack, brown hair, who was sitting upstairs. He had a rucksack. Then he came downstairs. I'm standing downstairs. I'm saying, why is the guy sitting upstairs, then sitting downstairs? To me, I came to the conclusion that he must have been the bomber. He must have planted something upstairs, then sat downstairs. And obviously he got off in the minute before the bomb went off when the bus driver opened the doors for no apparent reason when there was no bus stop.
Well, he sounds like an interesting chap, so I don't know if you can you just give us a, as full a description as you can of what he was
doing. He was a European male in his mid-20s, brown, mousy hair. I remember his kind of showerproof top. It was light grey, and the two-tone rucksack. And that's all I really remember of him. He did look at me hesitantly a couple of times, and I looked back at him. I thought he was just another lost kind of person. I thought that's what the reason he was looking at me. And he got off. He was actually the very last person to get off that bus before the driver shut the door, and then the bomb went off 60 seconds or so later.
See, now, many people might speculate that how come you can remember so much about this. Most people, when they're on the bus, if you were to tell them who went upstairs, who went downstairs, they would remember nothing.
I remember this like it was yesterday. I mean, for some reason, I was standing there. I was really thinking, I shouldn't be on this bus. I should be on the bus in front. That's why I was getting a bit agitated there, and I was seeing what was going on, the delays, and I was looking out the window and saying, why the hell is this bus getting nowhere? So when you're in that state, looking at things and questioning everything, that's how I am as a person, I suppose. I mean, I saw this guy, and the thing which made me ask questions was, why did the bus driver stop the bus when nobody had rung the bell and opened the middle doors and not open the front doors? That's what he did, and that's quite a few people got off from upstairs, a few people from downstairs as well, and then the very last person was this European man with brown hair, a light grey rainproof top, and a two-tone dark grey rucksack. So to me, that speaks volumes, because you have to ask yourself, things normally happen naturally. You ring the bell, bus driver stops, you get off. The bus driver doesn't just stop, open the doors, and no one rang the bell, okay? That's all I'm saying. That was an irregularity which drew my attention. And then here we have the African bus driver from the 205 in front staring at what remains of the bus to the rear. Let's see if we can zoom in on that. Yeah, just about, we can see the bus without a roof. And people were just in a panic. I actually picked myself up off the floor and just ran straight down towards this bus stop here. And I was just kind of incredulous when I turned around and saw the people at the top of the bus scratching their head as if, hey, what's going on? It's just very confusing for that moment. So I think that kind of outlines what happened in Tavistock Square and how we see people moving from one location to the other location, people claiming to be in this location when they were in that location, and the whole idea of the terror drills coincides with this idea that things were going off in various locations. At the same time, these terror drills were being coordinated. So it leads us to actually ask ourselves, is there a way that we can verify certain things about the Peter Power terror drills? And that's what we're here today. So, I mean, if anyone has any questions about the terror drills, because it's been on ITV and BBC and Radio London, so.
Yeah.
Like
you, I think it was an inside job, personally. But the one thing that goes against it is that guy who made that video saying he was a suicide martyr, that guy, not on the tube, on the train. What do you think about him? What does anyone else think about that?
That is, you're talking about Khan and Khan and Tanweer. There's information about Khan and Tanweer that they were already signed up to do jihad, and they had gone to Pakistan to do jihad and made those videos for that, but then it was cancelled, and then they came home, and then they were got picked up by British intelligence and were somehow used or...
Yes.
Or, but what you've got to understand is the two of them, they did a video because, hey, they believe in that. They believe in jihad. But that is slightly different from saying they planned and executed 7/7 on their own with bar of soap or a chapati flour or whatever they say.
Maybe.
Yeah, so I mean, but the one thing which goes against it being coordinated by them is, in fact, Hasib Hussein. Was he part of the training, the group of people who were training to do jihad? He was just a teenager who lived with his parents, and somehow he's been credited with destroying the bus bomb, whereas I was on board that bus and I never saw him. So that just makes me naturally ask questions about
the
first two.
Did you say you saw the MI5 just plant the bomb or something?
I didn't see him, I haven't got x-ray vision, I can't see upstairs, but I knew he was upstairs, then he came downstairs, and then the bus driver opened the door.
Some guy, James Chesbot, I don't know if you've heard of
him, he named the people who actually did the bomb. I think I've read his site, he claims to be MI5, but obviously he's probably worked for the services, but it's a bit of disinformation if he says he's given away his own people. You know what I mean? It doesn't make sense.
Mm. So,
yeah, it's interesting. Yeah, so...
Okay, so we've got a conjecture here.
Yeah.
That Hasib Hussein, the guy who's supposed to...
I think we've got some... Yeah, what's that about? Upstairs. Let me see. I'll also try and.
I'll tell you what, let's just go for it anyway. Look, we've got this guy, Hasib Hussein, who's supposed to have blown this bomb up. If he wasn't on the bus, what do you think may have happened to him? Because obviously his parents may believe, or some people in Leeds, where he's from, Beeston area, may believe that he's done this. So if he hasn't, if he wasn't on this bus, if what you're saying is correct, what happened to him, or where he died?
That's a very strange one. I mean, you've got to understand that terror is quite a big business for some people. So they have ways of disposing of people. Pretty. Who knows what happened to him that day? But he turned up in the morgue in Old Street, in the city of London, with all the rest of the people, and there is indications that certain people died in certain locations and were moved to other locations. So I mean, if they're keeping all the bodies in the same area, it's quite simple and a straightforward process for that.
And I don't know, do you have any idea of the condition of his body?
No,
because you see, these are really crucial facts. I mean, maybe the family do, maybe the family have seen the body. And that is another piece of evidence that we've really not seen. Is it, obviously, if the guy's a suicide bomber, there's not going to be a lot left of his body. It's going to be putting back together body parts, really, into a body bag and into a coffin, you know, for the funeral. So this is another aspect of it I'm curious about, is how much is actually known, to your knowledge, about whether families got these bodies back intact.
That's true. There is some footage which... is, I don't think people have focused on enough. There's a picture of Tanweer and Khan outside the Leeds train station. Let me see if I can pick it up. Tanweer and Khan outside the Leeds train station. Let me see if I can pick it up.
Luton, you mean?
Luton, yeah. See if I can get it. If you examine it closely, you'll notice something. Okay, let's see. There was some footage, that's what I'm looking for.
Actually, maybe you can just describe the footage.
Yeah.
and yeah. If we can find it, we'll yeah. stick it in.
Okay, what happened was, there is Tanwir and Khan are already at the train station. Now, they're waiting for Jermaine Lindsay. Now, as soon as Jermaine Lindsay shows up, watch what Tanwir does. Tanwir puts his hand, his left hand in his pocket and makes a phone call to someone. But you can just about spot it. So this gives me the impression that they had handlers, because as soon as Lindsay shows up, he contacts someone and say Lindsay has shown up. So I mean, that shows you that they could have been a fifth man. Some people
may have been, right? They may have been phoning Hasib Hussain, say where are you, you know.
They may have been, but Hasib Hussain, was he on the same train as them?
Well, he was supposed to be with them, wasn't he?
He was supposed to be. But I mean, when someone is calling to confirm like that, the way he did it, it was Tanwir was actually the leader. People think Khan is the leader. Khan was not, as if you look at Khan's demeanor, Khan, he's got one kid, he's got another kid on the way, he's a quiet sort of like person, although who knows, because he was a jihadist, he was, that's his ideology. I'm not saying he's not a jihadist, that's his ideology. But if you actually have a look at Tanwir was the ringleader. He was like, he's into this. He was the one in communications. He was the one at the front leading them. They've messed around with the photographs a lot going into the station, and people have already commented there's a bar going through a guy's leg and this, that and the other. So I wouldn't take those for gospel. But if you actually understand who's the ringleader and see how the ringleader is in contact with the fifth man, you know.
Right, because in initial reports, straight away after the bombings, we heard that there was this guy, Haroon Rashid Aswat, that had been in contact with all four of these guys, the alleged bombers.
Okay, where did you get that?
Yeah. In the week previous to, this guy, Haroon Rashid Aswat, who's from Dewsbury, which is not far from Leeds, and he has been very, very closely connected. Well, I mean, there's pictures of him with Abu Hamza in the back of a cab. I mean, he's a big friend of Abu Hamza. He's part of Al-Mujarun. Now, this guy has been sort of spirited away. He was taken to Kenya. Somehow he disappeared after the London bombings. He appeared in Kenya, and then he was arrested and then released. And then he went, I think it was to Pakistan, where he was also arrested and then released. And now he's apparently in Britain. In Belmarsh prison he was for a while, and now apparently he's in Broadmoor awaiting extradition to the United States. So here is another person who was connected with these four guys, who could possibly have been the person that Tanwir was talking to.
Maybe if it, yes, this fifth mysterious fifth person is someone who there had to be. To me, I believe they had handlers that could have been at least someone maybe within the security apparatus, because there's been a lot of talk about they may have been led or said we're on a part of a terror drill themselves, you know, who knows. So that's, we never came across that footage, but if you have a look at that footage when the two of them are waiting for Lindsay to show up and watch how Tanwir behaves.
Right, so is this CCTV footage, which is a bit jerky because it's not continuous, or is it proper film?
I think it's CCTV actually.
Okay, so is it quite a jerky film?
You can make out what you need. Okay. So I mean, as long as you can make out what you as long as you understood, that's what it's all about. Whether you're saying something or. All right, is there anything else? Peter Power himself, his radio interviews and ITV interviews are quite legendary. He did everything in his power to actually spread the fact around that he just happened to be carrying out these drills. So does anyone think there's a way of... I know online they're all talking about, oh, we could get him to actually put his point of view across, but I think he's tried to do that in a number of ways. Earlier you were saying that on the BBC website.
He's appeared on the BBC website, naming the company that he was doing the drills for. So you might want to have a look at that, Mike Rudin's blog.
What was the name of the company?
I can't remember, but it's up on Mike Rudin's blog. And they're, the interesting thing about them is that it's, well, it's a company that, that until about 2 years ago was organised the main arms fair in Britain.
Okay.
That is to say they have very, very close connections to private, what Eisenhower called the military industrial intelligence complex. Whatever they, so private profit through death and destruction is the company that is actually running this Visor Consultants Peter Power terror drill, which I found, I mean, first the first I saw, I didn't realise the significance of it, the name of the company, but somebody on our forum pointed out, ah, these are the people we were, he was someone that used to go down to Docklands to protest every year against the Dicey Arms Fair, where some of the most powerful multinationals in the Western world, particularly US, British and French, market their weapons, including illegal weapons. Some things like torture equipment were on sale there. Electric shock batons, this kind of thing.
Interesting.
And this is the same company that was actually commissioned this this Peter Power Advisor Consultants. I mean, in any normal world, this would be explosive news.
And the question is, how were they allowed to do that drill in the first place? Because they must have had permission.
They do drills all the time.
Yeah, it's true. Yeah, they do a lot of drills. And I think the thing is, why is it that this is not of no interest to the police? Well, to the police as well.
Yeah.
Anyone that's actually investigating the London bombings. Yeah. Now, you know, it looks to me as if the police have pretty much given up on it all.
What's your Tony? What's your personal take on London bombings? What do you personally think?
Well, I think the public and the press and the political classes have been conned by the London bombings into being getting behind further wars against Arabs for oil.
But do you think it was a false-flag terrorism operation?
I mean, I don't know about the technical terms, but I don't think it's by any means certain that the four guys that everybody has been told and assumed did it, actually did it. I mean, it's been trial by television, and there's been no inquest into these four guys' deaths, and there's been no inquiry. The other thing which makes me very suspicious is that the political capital that's to be gained from having an inquiry after it's been blocked by Blair and Brown, you would think that if Cameron wanted to pick up a few votes, he could stand up on a stage and say, I think there should be an inquiry. But he doesn't. In fact, he's totally against an inquiry. He believes that an inquiry would be a waste of time and money, and he's aggressively against it. Which is interesting, because David Davis appears to be supporting the idea of having an inquiry. I find it absolutely astounding, as an ex-reporter in a London radio station in GLR years ago, that the British establishment, that is to say that even the police are prepared to accept events as told to them by the Chief Commissioner of the Metropolitan Police on television. But that is, to them, is enough evidence to say what happened that day.
Not only that, but the mainstream media are willing to change their story in line to the story that the police changed. Because originally, the police were saying that forensic evidence said that the material used for the bombs was military-grade C4. And that they changed their story later. And this was backed up by friends. By the French police as well.
I believe, and I've put on the record many times now, that if there is no inquiry, this will happen again. We will have further bomb attacks in London. And this, to me, is a matter of national security, and I find it incredible that the police and the media are just not interested in it.
Yeah, but this is important too, Tony, because the police did change the story. First of all, they said it was village grade C4 explosives, and they said a forensics proved that there was traces of C4 and on the scenes, on the bomb scenes. And then they changed the story and said, no, it was only TATP. But in actual fact, TATP is only used to detonate bombs. TATP cannot explain the massive explosion and the ripping apart of the metal. TATP can only detonate. It's not a proper explosive. So they changed their story.
Yeah.
Why did they change their story? Nafees Ahmed and his group suggests that it could be that they don't want people to join the dots together, and it's something to do with weapons grade C4 that has come from some source that they don't want people to know. And the mainstream media were quite happy to change their story without asking questions of the police, saying, well, hang on a minute. You told us that the forensics said it was C4. Now you're saying it's only TATP.
Yeah. What you've got to understand is there were four bombers. Right, the first two were Tannery and Khan. Now these guys were, jihadists. So they brought along with them a couple of homemade devices. Okay, and they sat on board the trains. One of them was to Edge Railroad, the other was to wherever, and five or six people died. Okay, this was a homemade. Now, on the underground in the Russell Square explosion, about 26, 27 people died. On the bus, about more than a dozen people died. So you can see that there was a combination. Two of them were just homemade. Two of them were weapons grade. Now, the ones that are weapons grade, we have to ask ourselves, were these guys, did they know what they were doing? Because, okay, you think to yourself that the first two, they flew out to Pakistan. Maybe, who knows what they did out there? Maybe they were just at some wedding, but hey, they made some video saying that they were ready to go, ready to die, okay? So we can't argue with that, okay? So you have to ask yourself, there's a combination here. There is weapons grade, then there is homemade. The two guys who were the jihadists, they had the homemade. The two guys, maybe there weren't two other guys, there were just bombs which were weapons grade, which were planted. Mm. That's really how I suspect.
Hey Daniel,
myself.
We're really getting somewhere here because we're comparing notes and different bits of evidence, but I can tell you, when I worked for the Avon Fire Brigade, I worked in our exercises. And what we used to do, we used to simulate things very often. You'd sit in front of a camera and you pretend to be somebody. You pretend to be someone whose house was on fire. Right? You'd pretend to be, say for example, the chief fire officer who was in charge of an incident. You would then maybe pretend to be the chief fire officer back at headquarters, who's saying, "What's going on here? We'll send another fire engine." You might then pretend to be somebody who's actually on the ground. You know, you've got the right hat on or whatever, and you're in front of a camera. Now, that's how they conduct exercises. And I think it's quite feasible that Tanweer's video is just part of a terrorist exercise. Mm. Having actually seen, you know, and myself, been in front of cameras pretending to be somebody for a fire training exercise.
So he might have actually just been making the video thinking he was just acting the part.
I think it's quite feasible.
To me, I think that is not really.
I've seen these exercises run, and if he is helping MI5 or whatever, if he thinks he's helping MI5, then and he's friendly with all these people, then it's perfectly feasible that he would be persuaded to sit down and say, right now, pretend you're a terrorist as part of the drill. And off he goes. Oh, yeah, we're going to do something. You know,
I think you're trying to excuse.
Maybe, right? But it's another possibility. And also, he doesn't actually say anything in that video about doing an attack like the London bombs. He's talking about jihad as a struggle, and he doesn't make any kind of specific confession, if you want, about the London bombing.
I read somewhere about some New Zealand paper, they report about three blows, 11 shots, secret engineering warfare in London. I don't know where I read it,
Oh yeah, that's been mentioned on one of those. DVD. What's it called? Yeah, it was a New Zealand press and one other as well. And somebody tried to find out the reporter, someone from our group. You remember? We were at a meeting. Jasper tried to phone up. I can't remember what it was.
Well, I've got about another 8 minutes on here. I don't know how much
okay.
What you're going to do.
Let's have a look.
To have some sort of thing at the end, which is rounding it up and giving the book
the
a plug.
Which would be very crucial to the whole thing. Is we need
highlighted on the right at the back in this image from Luton Station on the 7th of July, appeared in a video released by the Arabic TV station Al Jazeera, attempting to justify the atrocity and threatening further violence. What you have witnessed now is only the beginning of a string of attacks that will continue and become stronger until you pull your forces out of Afghanistan and Iraq, and until you stop your financial and military support to America and Israel. His statement blaming the British public for the terror attacks because of their support for Western governments and Israel using force in Islamic countries has been intercut with images of bomb testing and a map of London, and comments from Ayman al-Zawahiri, regarded as a leading figure in
I think that's just BBC job, basically. He did actually, I believe that he believed what he was saying in that video. So I'm not gonna deny there are people who feel that jihadism is a way, something which they have to do and they commit to. But whether it's right or wrong, I'm not saying whether it's right or wrong, that people, that's how people feel. I'm a man who is a Christian, and I know that some people find it absurd as well to believe that there's a Christ figure and a thing like that, but that's how it goes. So I'm not going to be judgmental on that count, but I do actually think what you said about maybe that video was a test. No, I just believe he was, sometimes you get picked up by the cops, sometimes you get picked up by the police. I mean, a person who's, I haven't had any dealings with the police, but I know people who have, and what they do is they manipulate you to a point where they can use you. They won't necessarily come and do whatever it is you're doing, but they will manipulate you and use you, and I feel that's probably what happened to those two, and we can see the results. Myself, my own experiences, I've had involvement with anti-terrorist branch, and they were playing all these kind of psyops things with me, like, oh, why are you gonna say it? They thought I wouldn't say anything, and I did, and then I totally locked myself off for a few months and decided what I'm gonna do, because these people, I realized I saw something then. First, they put me under suspicion of being a suspect, which I was saying, this has got to stop. And then after a while, it wasn't stopping, even after they blamed these four individuals. So I said, I'm going to have to get my story out. I went to the press, and the press were going to, I realized the press were going to change my story. They were going to make me say that I saw Hasib Hussein on the bus, which was a lie. So I backed out of it. And then I wrote my book, The Fourth Bomb.
How are they going to make you say something?
They showed me a photograph and asked me to say, did you see this person on the bus? And I said no, and they said, think, remember back. You know how it is, they're trying to suggest, obviously I'm not dumb enough to actually say I saw something, which I didn't. It was one of those ones, so, I mean, hey, I'm not going for it, fair enough. I was back to my own means. It was only.
So did they show that?
They showed me a
picture. Show you saying no, I didn't see.
They showed me a picture of Hasib Hussein. This is before he was in the newspaper and everything like that. This was like days before, because I went to the press about a week after. But Hasib Hussein wasn't all over the newspapers until about 14, 15 days afterwards.
Yeah.
So they showed me this Asian kid, and I said no, I never saw him. I never saw any dude. Are you sure you never saw him? Yeah, I'm certain. You know, so I could see what was going on. They needed something to hang it on. And
so that was the police or the media saying that?
That was a guy from who worked for the Sunday Mirror. He worked for the Sunday Mirror, I was led to believe. But I've seen him on TV, working all over the place, who knows. But anyway, I didn't go for it, didn't buy it. And then I started keeping a note of everything that was happening. There was these guys, I'm going to work, they're where I work. I'm going to eat lunch, they're where I'm eating lunch. I'm going to jog in the park, they're in my park, stuff like that. So
who are these people?
I have absolutely no idea, but that's what they do for a living, okay? So I kept notes, took advice. I know people who are activists, they've been through this in the 70s. They say sometimes police will come and kick down your door and stuff like that. All that kind of malarkey, but that's slightly different. This is more to do with secret services rather than old Bill. So I consulted lawyers and I just kept a note of everything. Those notes in the end became a book because it was all about 7 months and they still hadn't asked me for a proper police statement. There's just all these dudes all over my case and I wasn't really too enamored with that.
So.
All over the place, yeah. Every time you see all this stuff I'm doing, every time I'm doing like my book launches, some of them try to attend, but I did the book launch with a Nigerian group, so the guys tried to get in and sorry mate, you weren't Nigerian. So obviously they do try and attend and stuff like that. But
they told you about the books, so they're friends.
I'm not really concerned. I mean, no one's threatened anything, it's just a book. In a sense, the book is what I've exercised my right to freedom of speech. Whether you want to say that my book is a fabrication, some people try to say that to me on my blog, and I know that these people are just angry about the book being available to the public. So the fourth bomb was launched in July of the following year, and it's just been something which people are beginning to understand that we are being lied to. I mean, when Blair was doing his jiggery pokery, people got the sense that this new Labour that they loved so much wasn't all it had painted itself to be. So, I mean, the book stands there, but it is a kind of good thing about this country. They're trying to take away our rights. So, I mean, I'm gonna stamp on the ground and say, this is my right. They actually got some big ass lawyers to send me some stuff, and they even bought it off my website, and then, you know, they looked over it, but obviously people are still trying to keep a barge pole distance from it as we speak because it's a bit of a hot potato.
So how can people, anyone that's listening to this, get your book?
There's a website called thefourthbomb.com which sells it. There are numerous shops in and around London, Houseman's and Centreprise in King's Cross and in Dalston, and a few other shops in South London as well. But online is the best place, the website. It also furnishes you with information and footage from that day, which is...
So Daniel, have you met with other people that have survived the 7/7 incidents, and how do they feel about your book?
I've met with people who know, who lost loved ones that day. So really, with me, I'm A-OK. So you've got a feel for them, really. That was, I think, about 18 months ago or so. But they've written books. I mean, a guy has done a film about it as well. It's called The Homefront Movie.
So Sikimi.
That's the one, yeah. So people have actually created something out of this as a reminder that 7/7 happened on the streets of London, and it's something we've got to get to grips with because our society is supposed to be the centre of democracy and things like that. So it's quite an eye-opener when you actually understand that.
Do you get the sense that they're concerned that 7/7 is used to clamp down on our civil liberties?
That's the general idea I'm getting. They're preparing London and society in general for what's to come. That's why people are getting in an awful kind of tears about 2012, because they think whatever it is they're preparing, that is going to be the point which it is cast upon us. So